Welkom bij Het Uur. Een nieuwe roman van Bret Easton Ellis. Dat is een ware literaire gebeurtenis. Het was al zo'n 10 jaar geleden. Shards, scherven. En hij keert terug naar de achtergrond van zijn jeugd. Los Angeles in de vroege jaren 80, waar zijn doorbraak Less Than Zero zich ook al afspeelde. Het maakte de jonge schrijver destijds op slag een ster. Er is ook een seriemoordenaar actief, net als in zijn beroemdste boek American Psycho. Bret Easton Ellis wordt nog steeds het enfant terrible van de Amerikaanse literatuur genoemd. Welkom bij Het Uur. Mijn naam is Pieter van der Wielen. So, Bret, nice having you here. Thanks for coming out.
Thanks for having me.
So, how do you like these book tours nowadays?
You know, it's funny. I was talking with Douglas Copeland, the author who coined the term Generation X, a Canadian novelist, quite well known in his country and I think known in other parts of the world. And he emailed me before I started this tour last week, and he said, "You're doing a book tour? Why are you doing a book tour at your age? You're 58. My God, why do a book tour?" And I said, "Well, yeah, you know, I owe it to my publishers and everything." He said, "But haven't you aged out of hooking up with groupies? I mean, haven't the fun of the book tour is like meeting people to like, you know, have sex and go to parties and like hang out late at night in the hotel bars and all that stuff. That's why you go on a book tour." At 58, you don't feel that. At 58, you don't feel the need to exhibit yourself in quite the same way you did when you were younger. And you had more energy and you had more stamina, the book tour becomes kind of work. And it takes you away from those comforts you have, you need as you age. And so for me, I haven't been to a party in 3 years. I don't go to screenings anymore. I have a partner I've lived with for 13 years. My ideal night is to finish work around 7 o'clock, 7:15, and then have my martini. I have a martini, and then we look around for something to eat in the kitchen. We decide on a TV show or a movie, and then I get into bed. That is the perfect night. And then I wake up whenever I wake up.
So you're also kind of like out of your comfort zone right now. This is like being de-rooted.
I am completely out of my comfort zone, but I'm feeling it in ways that I never felt it on earlier tours. I remember I really didn't do a book tour until my fifth book, until Glamorama, Less Than Zero. I was still in college. I wasn't taking time off. I was serious about graduating. I wasn't going to take 3 months off to do a book tour. So I got out of that with Less Than Zero when I was a college kid. And then Less Than Zero was a fairly successful novel. And when they published my second one, The Rules of Attraction, I kind of had some say at the publishing house, like, I don't want to do a book tour. I really don't want to do a book tour. American Psycho, no one wanted me to do a book tour. There was no book tour for American Psycho.
Because people were so shocked with the book that they didn't want to see you.
All my publishers dropped me. 30 European publishers dropped me.
You were canceled before it was even a word.
I was. Canceled in America, canceled all across Europe, except for the UK. They were the only publisher that did not cancel me. And then I published a novel in 1999 called Glamorama, which was a big book that was very widely hyped and publicized. And it was my first proper tour. 18 months of touring for that book.
And by then you were a star, strangely. While you were being canceled for American Psycho, it also became a huge success. And by the time of Glamorama, you were like a star.
I became a celebrity with the cancellation of American Psycho. I was a well-known author, young author, but the celebrity that I entered into with the cancellation of American Psycho was unlike anything. I mean, it really was a different kind of celebrity. It was also a very negative kind of celebrity. I was notorious. I wasn't loved. There's a difference between that kind of celebrity. It wasn't like, oh, we love him now and he's so wonderful. It's like, what a dick. What a terrible person. Who could possibly create Patrick Bateman? So I was notorious, and the celebrity was not warm and embracing. it was hard and it was filled with a lot of criticism. And it's been that way ever since. It really is up and down with me. I am not in America a beloved literary figure. I am the notorious, worst reviewed writer of my generation.
Is there also a part of anxiety when you go on a book tour, when you have to meet people, be interviewed?
No, not anymore. I don't have that. The only anxiety that I do have, and we were talking about this a bit earlier before we started taping, is that I get nervous before making an appearance in front of people on a stage with a live audience, which happened last night. And I do need about 5 minutes alone in whatever the dressing room is backstage to decompress a little bit. It used to be a lot worse. I used to get sick. I used to throw up before I went into a thing like that in, whatever. How many people were there last night? 400 people? I don't know how many. What? That's a lot of people to go in front of, and they have expectations, and you're expected to perform in a way. I don't perform. I'm just myself.
You have to entertain them.
Well, you know, that's the pressure. But I don't – I just feel the need to be authentic. I can't fake it and just like be entertaining for entertainment's sake. You know, I have to be myself or else I can't do it. I can't go on there and put on a performance for an hour and a half, which is what was required of me. So I'm just myself.
That's the funny thing about writers, that, you know, you become a writer by, well, basically being all by yourself in your little room writing and being in your head with your own fantasies and thoughts. And then once you become a success at it, you're expected to be an entertainer, to be outgoing and meet everybody and be a star.
I think that era of the writer's over. I think we're talking about an earlier era to a degree. I could be wrong, but I don't see the writer as a star in the way that he once was. I'm talking about the era of where I think it is dying out with the – I'm thinking of American writers like Philip Roth, Norman Mailer, Joan Didion, huge figures, huge literary figures, Susan Sontag, let's say. I don't know what the equivalents are here in Amsterdam or wherever, but there was a kind of rock star presence about – major literary American writers. I don't see it anywhere today. I don't know where that is. Writers are not at the center of the culture anymore. At least
they don't appear on television, hardly.
Hardly ever. They just don't carry the same weight that they once did. I think in some weird way, I'm reminded that I'm the last of a breed when certain people tell me about, oh, they remember reading my books in the 80s or the 90s and how glamorous it all seemed. And I know that there was a very big podcast that was very popular in the States about Donna Tartt and myself and another writer, Jonathan Lethem. We all went to the same university together. The podcast is called Down and Out at Bennington College, about 14 hours long. Esquire has done a story on that period and us as well. And it seems that people are interested in that last gasp of celebrity for a writer that was fairly big, you know, fairly big. I mean, I remember New York where writers, novelists were asked to walk the red carpet at movie premieres and people would take your pictures. And I remember doing, you know, fashion layouts for magazines at Industrious Studios in New York and wearing, you know, modeling the latest Armani or Calvin Klein. A bunch of writers, we were all down there. And it just seems like such a long ago era. But I also think novels mattered more. There was something about that time that just doesn't really connect to now.
So now you can go on the streets, you can go down a bar, you can go anywhere and people don't recognize you?
I was never recognized. That's the thing with being a well-known writer. No, when they would see the credit card, in a restaurant, if I lay down a credit card, or if I paid with a credit card in a department store and they saw the name, then I would be recognized. But I rarely, if ever, am recognized in public. I have a couple of friends who say they disagree with me. They say that they notice that I am recognized, but those people just don't want to come up and say hello to me.
Because you're notorious. Let's talk about the book, because I love the book.
We're talking about the shards?
Yes.
What's it called here in...
Scherven.
Scherven, okay.
Yeah, a lot of themes that you talked about in earlier books reappear in this book, but I feel this is the book that you wanted to write for a very long time, that maybe earlier books were kind of like side paths to this story that you wanted to tell.
Well, I wanted to write this novel for a very long time and could never figure out a way how to do it. I thought of this novel in 1982 when I was 18 years old. I was actually working on my first novel, Less Than Zero, when I interrupted Less Than Zero with this idea for the shards. And I suddenly wanted to write the shards because of a series of things that happened to me that really were the events that changed me from an adolescent into an adult. A kind of corruption occurred. I know that sounds very dramatic, but for everyone, it's a different age, I suppose. But for me, it was that senior year of high school, 17, 18, where a series of events happened that kind of changed my life and moved me into adulthood. And I wanted to write about that. I really wanted to write about all of these things that had happened to me and the person that I was and how I changed that year and had a bunch of realizations about myself and being a writer, and especially the dangers in being a writer, that it could be, if not controlled properly, a dangerous kind of superpower, and you had to control it in a way. There's a danger in embellishment and being a fabulist, you know, and to see things that aren't there and hear things that aren't being said. But that's what a writer does. You make up things. You make up narratives. But you can't make up stuff about people around you and your reality.
It's dangerous to do that.
That is dangerous to do.
It's what they say in the book about the character who's also called Brett.
Yes.
And they say he makes things up.
Yes.
He adapts the stories.
Well, he also creates narratives that are not true, that hurt people, that are, in fact, deadly. That's the metaphor in the shards. But the shards was complicated. It's a very narrative-driven book. A lot of stuff happens in it. And I made this outline in 1982. It hasn't changed at all. I mean, from the novel that I wrote the last couple of years, that's pretty much the novel I was thinking of. I didn't have, the chops, the talent to pull it off in 1982.
It was too difficult to write this.
It was too big. Too big. And also, I don't know, there was something so sensitive about it. I was very wounded by a lot of things that happened. I had a couple of friends who weren't speaking to me because of things I did. My girlfriend felt betrayed because I was gay, and I finally admitted it to her. I did not want to be at the school I was at where you had haircut regulations and you had to wear a uniform. I felt I was in a costume. I was going to classes I didn't want to take because I knew I wanted to be a writer. I thought this boy was in love with me who wasn't in love with me, and I made up a scenario about him. All of these things I was doing while working on Less Than Zero really came crashing down around me. Much as it does to the bread in the book, in different ways, but that's where the emotion came from. And so finally, I could do Less Than Zero, but I couldn't do the shards. Less Than Zero was kind of a vibey book. It wasn't strong on narrative.
It creates the atmosphere of that era,
right,
and that place.
I call it a hangout book. You hang out with it. It's not a narrative. It's not built to be, you know, this suspenseful driven thing. Less Than Zero is a mood. It's a vibe. It's a hangout book. You hang out with the characters. You go with them to a club, and then you go with them to a party, and then they're driving along Wilshire. I could write that book at 18 and 19. Yes, I could do that book, and it was condensed, and it was short, and I had conceived of it in very, very short chapters, some of them a paragraph or two. And I just really wanted to embody in that book this notion that I was feeling at the time, that numbness was a feeling. Numbness was a feeling. I know that sounds contradictory.
To feel nothing is actually to feel
something. Feel something. It is. How do you write about that? How do you figure out a character, and how do you express this in prose? And that was what Lesson Zero was to me. How do I get this drifting, numb feeling on the page? And who's the character? Who's the narrator who embodies this? And also, how do I do it? So very short chapters, very atmospheric. You think nothing's really happening in these three or four paragraph chapters. And maybe nothing is, but a mood has been constructed. And that's what I wanted to do with Lesson Zero. In the editing of that book, ultimately, when it landed at a publishing house, they were more interested in some of the seamier, grittier aspects of the novel. And it does speed up a bit narratively in the last quarter. It was less so in my original drafts.
But this numbness is also in the new book. It's kind of about a young boy who finally finds that he's getting pushed away from his social circles. He's becoming kind of socially isolated. He has friends. He has a girlfriend. He has boyfriends at school. He's part of the social circle, but he becomes isolated. He becomes kind of like a sociopath in a way.
Well, he kind of reminds me in some ways of Patrick Bateman from American Psycho, who says at one point or at two points, I want to fit in. I want to fit in. That's what Patrick Bateman says.
He wants to fit
to
in,
his
but
fiance.
He can't.
But he can't. Won't. And I see the Buckley School, where The Shards takes place, very much like the Manhattan in the late 80s that Patrick Bateman is stuck in. Brett is stuck in a similar situation. He wants to fit in. But fit into what? What happens when you realize there's really nowhere else to go? The world is the world. Manhattan is Manhattan. People are people. High school is high school. So what happens? Well, you try and fit in, and maybe you go a little bit mad, by trying to play this part. And I think what The Shards mirrored about my life is that I thought at a certain point in high school, I was going to really make an effort. I was really going
to
make
an effort to fit in, to be part of it.
Part of it. Like, I lost some weight. I worked out. I cut my hair. I looked really good. I dressed differently. I got this new car, and boom, I was dating the most popular girl in school. Boom, I had a couple of having sex with someone who was on the football team, who was closeted. A total cliche, I know. But I suddenly found myself in kind of this popular clique. I myself was not necessarily popular, but I became popular because I was part of this clique. Now, I could only keep it up for so long because it wasn't me. I wasn't being authentic. I was being what I call myself in The Shards, the tangible participant, someone who is trying to participate in the everyday life of high school. I kind of got away with it for a while, and then I didn't. I just could not keep up the facade.
But it's a world of pretty people that have money, that go to the cool places, that wear the right clothes. Tell me a bit about this time, the early 80s in L.A., where this book takes place. What kind of era was that?
Well, the more I look back on it, the more I think of freedom. There was a freedom there that just doesn't seem to exist today. There was a freedom from our parents. There was a longing to become an adult. You wanted to become an adult. You couldn't wait to become an adult. I do not see that now at all. I see people wanting to stay children, wanting to. I think 70% of the people who have bought stream the Disney Channel are like over 30. You know, people cosplaying at Comic-Con in their 40s, whatever. That would have been absurd to us as 17 and 18-year-olds who wanted to enter into the world of sex and adulthood and money and careers and all of this stuff. That's what we were striving for. And so I think that was a big difference. And I also think that, you know, there are so many things that are different about 1981 than now. But what I remember mostly about Los Angeles, at least, was that there was this vast freedom caused by mobility. You got your car at 15 and a half in LA. You got a learner's permit. You got your learner's permit from the DMV, which meant you could technically drive, but you would supposed to be with an adult. Most of us weren't. We were 15 and a half driving cars all over the place. And then at 16, you got your car, you were mobile. That's when you became an adult. That's when I stopped seeing my
freedom,
parents.
You could go places.
Anywhere.
And this Brett in the book, he has a 450 SL Mercedes, which in my opinion is the best car ever designed in the history of mankind.
Well, I agree. But it was
an expensive car at the time.
But it wasn't mine. It was my father's. I did not have that car.
You couldn't afford that. But to drive it even.
Oh, well, I did drive it whenever I could because, as you say, it is the greatest car made in the history of automotive industry. Okay? It is.
Period.
But it wasn't mine. It was my dad's. And in the novel, he is away. My mother and him are on this 3-month trip, sailing around the world, trying to fix their marriage in the fall of 1981. And I'm left alone at the house. So I'm all by myself in this house up on Mulholland in LA. And so because they were gone, I started driving this car. We're making this sound like this is a memoir. We're making this sound like this all really happened.
Which it isn't.
It isn't.
It's a fantasy story.
Right. But a lot of it is taken from my life. And the Brett that I am writing about within this novel is me. Is me. And so when I talk about it, it becomes this weird melding of fiction and a fact. Because that was Brett.
But people die in the book and horrible things take place and it becomes total horror at some points. So it's also dangerous in a way to make that up, to use yourself and your own history and to turn it into something cruel.
Yeah, but for me, it's all – because I'm the writer of it, I see the metaphor of it all. I see that the trawler, which is a serial killer that haunts the book, is a metaphor for creativity and being a writer in a way itself, as someone who is forming narratives through murders, home invasions. What they do to the bodies are very creative. So that's a metaphor.
Very horrible things. He mutilates the bodies in ways you cannot even imagine. You can imagine them, but...
Well, yes.
You did.
I did. And I also see, I see the book, the horror aspect of the book, the crime aspect of the book, to me was always a metaphor for a writer's life. And how there's not a lot of difference between being a writer who embellishes, makes up narrative, creates stories, creates terrible scenarios, wonderful scenarios, with that of a serial killer who was also creating a kind of narrative, who is also inducing an emotion from people who are reading about them. This serial killers also often send letters and notes to papers. Well, they used to. There really are no serial killers anymore. Mass shooters are the new serial killers. Serial killers can't exist and act on their own for years now because of technology. phones.
They would be caught immediately.
They'd be caught in a minute. So that's that was a very 70s and 80s thing, growing up with serial killers all over the place. We almost didn't take it seriously. It was just so constant.
Is something very innocent. No one dies. No one gets hurt.
People get hurt all the time with writing. People get hurt all the time. I've unfortunately have written books where people have gotten hurt. Now, we're not talking about getting violently shot or stabbed, but we're quite surprised that they saw themselves in a book of mine and never spoke to me again.
Because you used real people as inspiration.
But I always thought I was being caring and honest about what I saw and experienced, and I never named anybody. And I did write about my experiences with people. Some of them didn't like what I fictionalized. It was fiction, though they, you know, I remember someone telling me, you know, I can't believe you wrote that part of the book. And I said, why? And this person said, because everything you wrote happened. That scene in the restaurant between us, that scene in the car, the scene when we get into the fight of the thing, you used it all. And I said, yeah, but no one's really going to know it was you or it was me. I mean, that person who's narrating the book is not me. And that person is not you. I used these things that happened to us because I thought they were interesting and I thought they fit this novel. But I did not mean to hurt you or anything. Well, they didn't see it that way.
Could you write a book without using any real experiences or people or scenes or anything about your own life and just make it all up?
Yes, of course I could.
What would happen?
I have. I certainly have. There's tons of stuff in American Psycho that I made up. The satire of the guys on Wall Street. I observed enough to be able to use a lot of that when I was writing these scenes that weren't real. Certainly there's stuff in Lesson Zero that wasn't real. Most of the stuff that I've written is not autobiographical.
But do you feel it becomes better when you use something out of your own life?
Not necessarily. No, not necessarily. I think that there is stuff that I've used that I've had to use because it was important for me to process what happened and why I was confused by this situation and why it pained me and why I'm feeling this way about it. And writing has always been a way of helping me understand myself better and certain situations I was in. That's just how it's always worked for me.
Because you said that you couldn't fit in. You tried fitting in.
I did.
You failed.
I failed.
And then you became a writer.
And then I became a writer.
So writing is also a way of dealing with the fact that you don't fit in.
Well, you know what? I got to tell you, where have I fit in? I've never fit in with the literary establishment. I never fit in with the New York literary scene. I was never asked to be on panels. I was never asked to review books. No universities ever invited me. I was never endowed or given, you know, awards. I was always an outsider, and I've always felt myself as an outsider.
Well,
in that
respect. Why would you want to fit in?
I don't want to fit in.
You don't need to.
I don't
have to.
I don't want to. I have no desire to. But and I like being an individual, and I like having my own space, my own world, and I don't really write like anyone else, and whatever. I like that. That's fine. I mean, I like it, not like it, whatever. But I do. But we're talking about 17 and 18, and I did at one point want to fit in. I didn't want to be gay. I don't want to be. I realize. Oh,
you didn't.
This is going to be a hardship.
Gay. Yeah,
this is going to be a hardship. This is. I get it, but I'm also not going to have a nervous breakdown about it. I'm going to be pragmatic about it, and I'm not going to let it torture me at all. But you know, there was that, and there was that need, that high school need, that I really hadn't had before because my life was pretty full. I loved film. I loved music. I saw bands. I read every book that came out. I was writing short stories. I was writing comic books. I was the movie critic for our school paper. My life was filled. But something happened. I fell in love with someone, I think. Lust overtook everything. Everything became about sex. And so I suddenly wanted to look really good and look like a hot 17-year-old, which then, you know, it's hard now at 58, but it's pretty easy to get your act together at 17 or 18. And so I went through this kind of metamorphosis, and I just became this kind of person that I never really thought I would be, but I found that it was very attractive to a lot of people. And so I was kind of flattered, and I liked it. I couldn't keep it up. It was a facade. It wasn't me. I wasn't the shallow, masculine boyfriend that my girlfriend thought I was. I wasn't the person who could go with two other couples to, I don't know, some dumb club and pretend it was the funnest night of my life, or go to like a pool party. And
it became like a double life in the book.
Well,
Brett, in the book, you know, he's trying to keep up with the girlfriend, and he's trying to make it look like everything's cool. But
he's not doing a good job.
He's
and
not
she's
doing a
she's
good
kind
job.
Of not happy about it, and then sometimes she is, and whatever. So it didn't work, and that's what The Shards is about. And The Shards is about that year of where I tried to be something that I wasn't, and I caused a lot of pain among classmates. And it was the year, look, for better or for worse, that I grew up. I became a man.
And the violence is like a metaphor for that rupture. Did anything you write ever scare you yourself? Were you ever shocked by anything that came out of your own pen?
No. It's fiction. It's made up. I'm scared of things in real life, I guess. You know, real life has some scary things in it. But in terms of writing fiction, no, I'm not that frightened about the things that I write. Or I'm not really that aroused by the sex that I write. People have pointed out The Shards has too many sex scenes. I don't think a book can have too many sex scenes, but there's a lot of sex scenes in The Shards, both straight and gay. I'm not aroused by those. I find writing to be pure happiness. I love writing books. I wish I had written more. I'm in a state of bliss when I'm working on a piece of fiction, and I just look forward to every morning going into that office, knowing that book is there. That book is my friend. That book is my lover. That book is someone I love hanging out with for 14 hours a day when it's going
really well.
But it's
a state of bliss, and people get killed.
So I'm not scared.
Murdered, and
there's no fear.
But you said, and I love that you said it, like Flaubert said, Madame Bovary, c'est moi.
Yeah.
You said Bateman, c'est moi.
I did say that, but I also believe Flaubert said, in order to write like a revolutionary, you need to live like a bourgeois. And I believe that. You have to have calmness, order, no chaos in your life in order to write some of that horror and in order to write some of that imagery and some of the horrific things that happen in The Shards. I need complete order. My bed has to be made. The kitchen has to be clean.
So you can write.
So I can write. And when I'm writing, no matter what I'm writing, I am just in a state of kind of exalted, I don't know what you could call it. I'm just in this exalted state, and I love being there, and I love figuring things out, and I love rewriting, and the whole process is so pleasurable
and
to
making
me.
Making it work and working out.
So I would never be scared of something that
but
I wrote.
But it's also, and you know, American Psycho is very much about people who live for the outside. They go to the right places, wear the right shoes, they say the right things, they're living a facade. But also it's about the darkness of people. The things they cannot talk about, the things they cannot show to one another. There might be a serial killer in each and every one of us, at least in our fantasies, maybe. We all have dark sides that we rather wouldn't address. And it's it's interesting to see that in a book, that people can have those double lives. That seems to be a theme in most things that you write in some way. The darkness.
That's life. That's truth. That's reality. That's authentic. To not write about that or to deny this duality that we all have is a lie and I think immoral. I think we do it in society where everyone is expected to be this perfect, bland person who says the right things all the time and follows in with whatever the acceptable group speak is of the moment and is being turned into neutered little sheep. I mean, that's happening in society. That's not a real person. A real person is messy. A real person, a real man has sexist thoughts, if you want to put it that way. We're all racist, I think, to some degree or another, if we really want to have that conversation and lay it out on the table and talk about it. But our society doesn't want us to. Society really wants to push all that messiness, all that realness about us and make us into these clockwork oranges. That idea that Anthony Burgess came up with and that Kubrick made that film about. How do you turn a man into a servile, non-violent person whose all of his instincts are wiped away? Well, that's wiping away God.
That's what's happening now with the cancel culture and social media and people all trying to
language police. I'm toxic masculinity. What the fuck is toxic masculinity? I mean, that's a derogatory comment about normal male biological behavior. I mean, that's absurd. Hate speech? What the fuck is hate speech? I don't even know what that is. There's no such thing as hate speech. I mean, all of these things that have been thrown at us to shut us up or to turn us into clockwork oranges or to these neutered people that are acceptable by who? That part of society? I don't want to be part of that society. Fuck that part of society. I'm an individual and I want to say what I want to say. I don't want to hurt anybody. I'm not going to punch someone out. But if you're going to start telling me that I can't say this or I shouldn't say that or I can't write this, well, my attitude is fuck you. I'm not listening to that.
Because you had some people, you know, who were offended by tweets that you send out.
That's absurd. To be offended by a tweet, you need to see a shrink. And by the way, I don't think they were offended. I don't believe it. They're not offended by the tweet. They want to be offended or they want to show their virtuous side. Like, oh, this is a terrible thing to be saying by someone. I'm such a humanist. How dare Brett make that joke? Look at me. I'm smelling my own farts, and aren't they smelling so fantastic? That's what they're doing. Really? Is someone offended by a tweet? I doubt it. It's a power play to cancel someone.
So actually, that's, you know, like the people in American Psycho that wear the right clothes, it's like you put on the same moral virtue as if it was a coat. It's all about you. It's about showing you're on the right side and you have the right opinions.
And some people do it and some people don't. And I don't know. I don't know where it gets people. I mean, I guess it gets some people right now. It helps them keep their jobs. I don't know.
Afraid to be fired. Maybe it should be a rule not to tweet anything after 9 o'clock in the evening or after.
I haven't tweeted anything in years. I don't even control my own Twitter site anymore. It's controlled by my publisher and by a couple of people who run my Patreon site where my podcast is. I haven't tweeted anything.
Because
Twitter's not fun. Twitter's lost its fun. I wrote about this in White, my book of essays, a chapter about Twitter and how it changed and how it evolved and how it was so fun when it was the Wild West and you could be obscene on it. You could say anything you want. And that's what Twitter seemed to be like. The fact that it turned into this sort of like, I'm better than you, virtuous, like, you know, machine was a horrifying shock. And that people were going to cancel you or get mad at you because of a dumb joke you made. I mean, that was when Twitter was, you realized, okay, I'm out of here. Can't do it. Doesn't work. And I still think that way. So I haven't been on Twitter in a long time.
But it could be one of the functions, if literature has a function, to show the dark side, explore the dark side, say the things that you otherwise cannot say, to kind of explore the boundaries of society in a way, to be morally free of all that pressure. You can do that in fiction, if you like. So you can write about murder or rape or sexism, anything.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think a lot of people now feel more more concerned about doing that because of all of the sensitivity readers and the trigger readers that are at publishing houses now. I think people are a little more worried about exploring those dark sides because of how censorious our society has come about content and about jokes and about the wrong person playing the part of someone in a movie because they're not that person. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I think to be an artist right now, you're in a really precarious position unless you're just a blanded out person and is just doing Netflix movies for the money or whatever. I mean, I do hope and I do see it in Gen X. I see a backlash and I see some interesting things starting to come out questioning all of this. Finally, because it has to be questioned. No one can live under this kind of slavery, and I know I'm using that word, people, without having to breathe, choke, gasp for air, whatever. No one can really live or express themselves under this sort of authoritarian regime that has, you know, engulfed the conversation. It's not sustainable. So my hope is that there is pushback and that there is a lot of questioning about what's been going on in the last 5 or 6 years with this kind of strict librarian approach to language and free expression and content creation and supposed progressivism.
Yeah, because if you want to do something against, say, racism, you need to look at the darkness inside yourself. You need to see the evil inside
yourself. But we can't have that conversation because it's considered racist. You can't have that conversation.
No, so you're saying you're free of any kind of bigotry, which is, you know, then you don't get any further. You need to look at the wrongdoings of yourself.
But who's,
as well.
But who's doing that?
Well,
who's
nobody that? Dares to, because you cannot talk about
that's
anything.
That's the conversation that we should be having. We should be having conversations about the FBI crime statistics. I mean, we should be having that conversation, and yet everyone's too afraid to have that conversation. You know, everyone's too afraid to even talk about how certain groups, whether it was the Women's March or Black Lives Matters, completely collapsed into corruption. You know, they don't you can't have these conversations because they're considered sexist or racist when, in fact, they're just reality. And we have to deal with reality. But that side doesn't want to deal with reality. They have a narrative. And if we don't follow that narrative, then they don't want to talk about it at all. They just don't want to have that conversation.
Because it's dangerous.
So this is, and it's dangerous, and it's going to implode. It's going to explode in their faces. I talked about all of this in White in 2019, and I lost friends. I lost liberal friends who just did not like at all what I was proposing. That everything I was saying, that this is going to get out of hand, this language policing, this constricting artists in order to not be able to say things that they want to say in their art, comedians not being able to make jokes, everything is going to end up being racist and sexist at one point. I wrote about all of this, and I had friends, and I tried to understand the appeal of Donald Trump. I wanted to try and understand, but that made me a traitor. Even trying to understand the appeal of Trump made me a traitor on the left and with liberals, and I was dropped by many friends.
You know, it's funny now that you mention him that he already plays quite a role in American Psycho, yes. back in the day, because Bateman saw Trump as his hero, as like a father figure.
Yeah.
He was trying to be that
he did.
Person.
He did.
The ultimate person going for the money, for the looks, for the outside.
Yeah.
Without any moral inside.
Yeah, that's true. But the people who dropped me and stopped speaking to me, many of them have come back. I can tell you in the last year or so, I've had, you know, not 40 or 50, but 6 or 7 emails from friends who said, you know, I was so mad at you with that book. It pissed me off so much, but you were totally right. It all happened. It was, you were prescient. The left did go insane. You warned this. You said the left, the side that I've always been on, it's a gay liberal man, is going insane and having meltdowns, and they're going to destroy themselves. I wrote about this in 2018 and 2019, and no one wanted to hear it then. And I said, it's going to get out of hand. Everyone is on this list. If you think that you're pointing someone out because of something they said, a joke they made in an elevator, and they lose their tenure, believe me, you're going to be on that list too. No one escapes it. I have gotten a lot of emails lately going, you were completely correct. I don't know, 2019 was an emotional year, I guess, whatever, but it's all coming true. And you caught it, and I just want to say I'm sorry that I walked away from you.
Well, it's totally okay in a polarized society to say that both sides are wrong.
Both sides are wrong.
Why can't we just say that both sides are
I think,
crazy?
Well, you know, look, I got to tell you, I was talking about this, about having a – in a more successful podcast than the one I have. And, you know, we've been trying to figure out a way how to get more subscribers, my producer and I. And then we finally gave up because we're not going to do look, I did a podcast, I don't know what, a month ago where I talked for an hour and 15 minutes about my favorite foreign movies of 2022. Now, there's an audience for that. But there's a giant audience, and our numbers were a lot bigger when we were doing politics and when we were getting angry about something, you know. And but I'm just not that person, and I can't do that, and I can't scream into a mic, you know, four times a week about the political things because I don't care. But why was I talking about this? Oh, because
Both sides,
right. And I'm not on the left. I'm not on the right. I am not anywhere right now. I am completely in the middle, and I am completely free of news. I keep up barely with what's going on in terms of watching the news. I certainly hear stuff from friends, but we don't keep any channels on. In our house in LA, and we have 3 TVs. All of them are on the Food Network. We keep it on the Food Network, baking shows, cooking shows. That's what we keep on. And I can barely skim through the LA Times or the New York Times. I mean, the New York Times is a joke. I mean, you can. It's all in code.
So you're just looking cakes and pies.
Yeah.
And
well,
and
it's a lot more real than the news we're getting. I mean, everything is fake. It's all fake news. Everything is fake. It's all slanted. That's why it's fake. It's not that things aren't happening. It's slanted in a way. To support a narrative that one regime wants. That's what it is. But they all fall apart, you know? So I don't know how long this can keep going. I think that a lot of people like living in a delusion.
Let's talk about your father, because I think your father is an important figure in your life, of course, but also in discovering the darkness of mankind, discovering that people can have different sides to their personality. One they show and one they don't show. Are you still struggling with your dad?
No, not at all.
When did you stop struggling?
When I wrote a novel called Lunar Park, which was really about, I was going through something, as I always am when I write a novel. One of the things was my father's premature death at 50. This was in 1992.
So you're older now than he ever
was. I am. He didn't take very good care of himself. I had not spoken to him a year before he died. We were estranged. He was not rational. He was angry. He was treating my mother terribly. They were divorced or about to be divorced. I was sick of him. I was sick of his abuse, and I was sick of his anger, and I was sick of his narcissism. And, you know, I really tried. I had really tried to be a certain kind of son that I thought he wanted. Whatever, too late. I just wasn't it. I wrote this book, Lunar Park. It's kind of a ghost story. It's about a guy who's haunted by the ghost of his father. And in the end, there's the cliched scene of, you know, spreading the dad's ashes out there. And I just turned it into something that was very kind of grand and poetic and very heartfelt. And I felt my problems with my father lift off of me as I wrote these three or four pages. And I know it sounds so sappy and cliched, but my God, I just felt so free. Because feeling angry at your father and for him not being there for you, and I think every boy needs a father. The guys I know who have no fathers or had horrible fathers are a bit of a mess. And the guys I know who had great fathers and fathers who were there are pretty good individuals, I have to say. They're grounded in a way that boys without fathers aren't. And I also really came to understand and sympathize with my father's issues about being a man of a certain time. He was born in 1941. He came up of age in the height of the American Empire. You know, he was a football player. He was a successful real estate man. And I think he had expectations about his children that just were not realistic. And I was the son that just wasn't the son he wanted.
You didn't
and
live up to the out. Picture.
He checked
again.
Out. He checked out.
Would you have become a writer if he had treated you differently?
This haunts me, that notion. Did I become the artist and the writer that I did become because of my father's neglect and abuse? And, you know, the answer more often than not is yes. Because without that, I wouldn't have escaped into novels at such an early age. I wouldn't have escaped into the world of movies where I could hide in a movie and be a voyeur. I think it sparked my creativity. But some days I wonder, would I have been happier? Would I have been more well-adjusted? Would I have been better at business? I'm a terrible businessman. Would I have been better at business if my dad had been there for me, helped guide me through childhood and adolescence? And the answer is undoubtedly yes. He just didn't. So, you know, you win some, you lose some. I think now at this point in my life, I am grateful in a lot of ways because I forgive him. So I can be grateful. I forgive my dad that this is how it landed for me, that this is how it happened. He turned me into an artist.
There's also this notion that comes with it that you can come closer to truth by going into your fantasy, by fiction. That fiction is actually a way to come to something that is truthful.
Unbelievably true. Yes, always true. Everything that I've written has been a reflection of what is going on in my life. And in some ways, in many ways, it's much more vivid and getting at a truth than any kind of document I would write about what really happened to me that day and that I signed. You know, there is something so vivid about that, what you could call the fictional truth of a certain narrative. The metaphor of it can be so much more powerful than the reality that you're trying to express. That's why I think, for example, why the trawler is so scary to people in the Shards. is because he's a rather mundane metaphor for the creative process. But when you write about that through this vicious serial killer, it becomes such a powerful idea because this person is creating the most ghastly and the scariest carnage, and he's calling it's a project for him, the remakings, the assemblages. Why haven't you noticed my work, he calls into the LAPD. So the trawler for me was always like the very dark side of creativity and where it can lead. And in a way, if I just said, well, you know, creativity can be kind of deadly at times and, you know, maybe some people will get hurt. But if you want to express that idea with the trawler, it really pops. So you're right.
It's also cool that both in American Psycho and in this book that you never, as a reader, know what is true and what is not. You cannot trust the story. So it's like, did these people get killed or not? Was the guy a killer? Was he not? Is this all just a dream? Is this real? It's great that you as a reader can get lost in those doubts.
I don't know if if that matters that much to me in a way, if that's really what the books are about ultimately in the end. I do think that I'm not sure Patrick Bateman is an unreliable narrator. I think he's telling us really about what he's experiencing, and this is his life. Now, maybe the murders are fantasies, but maybe they're real. I mean, I think what Patrick Bateman is experiencing is actually an insane world. He's living in a world where he is right about a lot of the shit he notices and complains about. He is correct about his reaction and his satirizing the world of men and the world of wealth he's a part of. I don't think Patrick Bateman is wrong about some stuff. I think he's pretty much got it, but he's just lost in this insane world. It's not as if Patrick Bateman is moving through a normal society. He's moving through an insane society. So I don't know. And I also, there is an unreliability, I suppose, about the shards, but I think really only in one case is there a mystery where there is an evasion and the writer doesn't answer it, but there's something very eerie about that. The reader can put it together quite easily. I'm talking about the notion that Brett, the character, might have been part of whatever happens near the end of the book. The reader can pretty much put that together. And I think it's interesting, and it was purposeful, that the narrator avoids confirming that.
You can find out. It's pretty obvious.
I think so too.
Let's not spoil the book for anybody.
No. So I don't know. I really don't know in terms of the unreliable narrator. All I know is that when I read books growing up where there was an unreliable narrator, and I think it was either Nabokov, I forgot, maybe it was Pale Fire, I don't know. There was a moment where you realize, oh, he's not telling us the full truth. He's evading something. That's so interesting. The book got like 1,000 times more interesting to me. And whenever I came across fiction like that, where I realized the narrator was purposefully omitting things or misguiding us, that I got excited. I thought, that's really interesting. That's so much more interesting. Now, writers don't do that a lot. It's you know. And I have done it once or twice, but I don't know why I get called out on this. I think if you read my work, you can pretty much see that there really isn't an unreliable narrator, or conversely, every narrator in a novel is unreliable. It's a novel. It's a made-up story.
Well, it's great to have had you here, and I wish you a great book tour. Thanks.
Well, thanks for having me.
For being here. Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
En dat was Het Uur voor deze week. Volgende week, dan zijn we er weer. Het Uur wordt gemaakt door Mira Zeehandelaar en de chef van de audioredactie is Anne Moraal. Tot volgende week.